Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson, and tonight I'm joined by a man who knows that if he wants to talk to my girlfriend, he talks to me first. And if he wants to dance with her, then he applies in writing 3 weeks in advance, or he's going to end up inside a fucking bin bag. Yes, it's Chris Webb.
Fucking bin bag.
I like that.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good.
It's nice to have you back.
It's nice to be back after my untimely absence.
In your COVID 2.
Yeah.
The revenge.
COVID 2, the revenge. It was terrible, actually.
And you couldn't have joined on a better night because, as our listeners can probably hear, it's raining quite heavily on our corrugated iron roof. So I think that's just going to add to the ambience tonight.
It is, yes. We've got a heavy rain warning in force for Hawke's Bay at the moment, actually. Mm. So a lot of atmospheric white noise in the background.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of our listeners may say there's not much change there.
No.
How was the Tales of the Unexpected episode without me? Was it nice kind of not having me there for a change?
Well, it was nice, but different.
Yeah.
Because you weren't there. Obviously, I was flying solo in the garage, not for the first time.
No.
And it was obviously very nice to talk with Tyler. That's always good, and it was an enjoyable episode. It came out yesterday.
Yeah.
Hopefully, our listeners are enjoying that one, but it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, I had a lot of FOMO, actually. I felt a bit like Woody Harrelson in Indecent Proposal, knowing that Robert Redford's boning Demi Moore.
No money exchanged hands or anything else that was exchanged. I want to stress that straight away.
Okay, indecent podcast.
Well, it certainly was that. If you've listened to it, there's some potentially libelous stuff at the end. So.
No, well, I'm looking forward to getting Tyler back on the show because I'd missed out on talking to him again. He's a great guest.
He is a good cove. We like Tyler, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So tonight, Chris, it was your choice.
It certainly is.
What have you got for us?
Well, I have gone back to 1994. When I first selected this film, I thought, oh, it's too recent. And then I realised it's 28 years old.
Jesus.
Yeah, so 28 years later.
Oh,
thank you very much. That just came right off the top of my brain.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, thank you. I have chosen from 1994, Shallow Grave.
I'd like to ask you about your hobbies.
Why do you want a room here?
Do you smoke?
You must be Hugo.
So, I can have the room?
Yes, you can have the room.
Yeah, Hugo, can you open your door?
Alex, what are you doing?
I'm just looking.
Don't.
Don't look?
No.
It's not every day I find a story in my own flat.
It's not a story, Alex, it's a corpse.
It's a sick idea, Alex. It's sick.
Well, go ahead, then. Telephone.
Telephone the police.
Tell them there's a suitcase full of money and you don't want it.
I can't do it.
It's been a struggle, but now our days of worry are over.
To love and to happiness forever.
Good choice. Now what's your relationship to this one?
Well, I'm one of the, I don't know if it was one of the few people, but I saw it when it came out in the cinema. I remember seeing it reviewed on some really kind of hip film review show on Channel 4. I think it was like Movie Watch with Johnny Vaughan, which was a show where he'd get like students in and they would review films. And opinions were divided on it. Some people thought it was like really, really good and really, really cool and very, very exciting. And some people said it was the most, it was horrible, it was disgusting and all this. So I thought, yeah, gotta see that.
Yeah.
I even remember the cinema. Went to see it at the Screen in Reigate.
Ooh.
Because I was living in Surrey at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because this was at a time where, you know, everyone talks about, you know, the new British film era and Cool Britannia and all that bollocks. And it sort of started around about this time.
Yeah.
I can't think of any British films especially that were similar to this before this. I mean, obviously, it's on the coattails of other cool crime or neo-noir thrillers, things like Reservoir Dogs or The Last Seduction, or especially things like Blood Simple.
Yeah.
Of that sort of very, very low budget, very, very tense, people falling out over money kind of thing. But I hadn't seen anything.
But it's British.
But it's British.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen anything like this being made in Britain, particularly with, if you think of things like the soundtrack, you know, somebody said, oh, you've got to go and see it. They put loads of Left Field and things like that. None of those sort of rave culture films had come out at this point, or any of the Irvin Welsh stuff or anything like that.
What's next? A soundtrack by Orbital?
I know.
Yeah.
Or The Orb. It'd be a very long film if it was by The Orb. I thought it was really, really exciting. I did think it was cool.
Yeah.
It was at times very scary.
Yeah.
Very, very enjoyable. At times very, very funny as well. Mm-hmm. So I just absolutely loved it. Mm. And I'd seen it a few times since, but as is the rule, not for a while. What about you? You seen it before?
So I was 13 when this came out, but I didn't watch it until about 5 years later when it was on TV. I distinctly remember the experience of watching this because I hadn't been too interested in it. Loved Trainspotting.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like, oh, well, Trainspotting is the movie that kind of made Ewan McGregor and Danny Boyle. Mm. Shelley Grey was probably just like the kind of a bit shit first effort. And so it never really kind of intrigued me. The evening that this was on, it was a Sunday night, and I was watching this in my sort of dorm. It was like in a little apartment at university with my best friend and my then girlfriend.
It's not Chris Pheasant again, was it?
Wasn't Chris Pheasant. No. Chris Pheasant, who's just had a baby. Yeah, he posted it on Facebook recently.
Oh, congratulations to Chris and your little pheasant.
His little thrush. and so I was watching this with my best friend and my girlfriend, and it was kind of unsettling because it was a very sort of similar
very similar dynamic.
By the end of it, we may have had, I don't know, maybe like a couple of herbal jazz cigarettes.
Okay.
Sort of later. Yeah, by the end of it, I just remember that chilling couple of scenes, Kerry Fox just absolutely hysterical in the car, distraught. You know, we flipped it off after it and we just all sort of looked at each other and
you just kind of go, oh.
I'm just going to go to the kitchen and put the knives away. So I just remember being really unsettled and kind of just the nihilism of it and how kind of friendships can fall apart and trust can go away and all that kind of stuff. But loved it. Thought it was great. Haven't revisited it since.
Okay.
So, wow. Yeah. So I was very pleased when you pulled this one out.
Yeah. It's very much a film of debuts.
It is.
The feature or starring debut of Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
He'd been in Dennis Potter's Lipstick on Your Collar prior to this.
It was TV though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think he'd had a few small parts, but this is his first kind of banner role. Obviously, the directorial debut of Danny Boyle.
Yep.
And also the first screenplay from John Hodge.
Yes. Also, very low budget, filmed in 30 days, but it was the most commercially successful British film of 1995.
Yeah.
So really launched those three gentlemen. It was interesting though, because I was reading an article about Andrew McDonald, who was the producer. It was an interview from a BBC Scotland documentary that he had done.
Digging Your Own Grave.
Yeah. And he was saying that they nearly fired McGregor from the film because apparently Channel 4 thought he was too good looking.
But he is.
They had questions around Christopher Eccleston as well. And apparently it was Kerry Fox that got the whole thing green lit.
Well, she's the first name on the credits.
Yeah. Which, you know, Kerry Fox, of course, for our New Zealand listeners, a New Zealand actor.
And she does sort of maintain the New Zealand accent through it. Yeah.
I've written that in my notes. I think she really does maintain, an expat Kiwi who's living in Britain.
She's got that half and half accent
going on.
She's got
the half and half, but she's not trying to affect anything. Yeah, Kerry Fox was always an exciting kind of... You're growing up in my generation, there were very few actors, New Zealand actors, who sort of had international careers.
Yes, yeah.
You know, sort of Sam Neill. That's about
Tim Lurie Morrison, maybe.
Well, yeah, but not really at this point.
No.
Yeah, and Kerry Fox, of course, rose to fame with An Angel at My Table, directed by Jane Campion. And I remember being really proud of her for being this Kiwi with an international film career. She's made a career tackling difficult material, most famously perhaps performing unsimulated fellatio on the BFG.
Intimacy!
Yes! Intimacy! I sort of went down a bit of an intimacy rabbit hole when I was...
I bet you did.
When I was researching
so
this
film.
I ended up reading this Guardian article from 2001 by her then boyfriend, now husband, Alexander Linklater. He wrote this big article in The Guardian about how jealous he was and how kind of awkward it was watching her give Mark Rylance a blowjob. But, you know, that's really all I had to say about that.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. But interestingly, Kerry Fox almost wasn't in it either.
Okay.
I watched that Digging Your Own Grave short film, the documentary.
Yeah.
Initially, Equity refused her work visa because they thought there were already enough Australasian actresses in Britain and they didn't want another one coming in taking our jobs.
Yeah.
It was only about 4 days before shooting started that she got the visa. They didn't tell her that.
Wow, okay.
They brought her in for rehearsals and fittings and I think they all shared a flat for a bit.
Yeah.
But it was only at that very, very late stage that she actually got the gig.
Yeah,
and they didn't have a replacement.
Wow.
So it nearly shut the whole thing down.
And she's really good in this.
She's great. She's really good.
I was watching it thinking, God, why didn't she have a bigger career in the end? And I was looking at her filmography and she's done heaps of stuff. She's still been in heaps of movies, a lot of television. Things like, you know, Midsummer Murders and things that you kind of wouldn't expect her to pop up in. And yeah, just sort of wonder why after this kind of early promise and success that she never really kind of made it.
Yeah.
Big. And maybe she's got the career that she wants, you know, doing these sort of smaller things. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
It is a shame because she, you're absolutely right, she is ever so good in this. Obviously, yeah. That since then, the limelight has shone on Christopher Eccleston and in particular, Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But she is definitely their equal as far as performance goes in this.
Yeah.
It's not as showy as the other two.
No.
But I think it's more powerful. If this is like a neo-noir, she plays that femme fatale very, very well.
Very well. And like you say, a strength and a power and kind of elegance.
Yeah. And the way that she influences both of them to her will.
Subtly sort of manipulative. Yeah. And yeah. Yes, and of course, Ewan McGregor with a hairstyle that eerily predicts his Star Wars Episode II Obi-Wan mullet.
He's got beautiful hair in this.
He has.
Yeah.
And some really big white sports socks. The ones that Michael Jackson used to have popping out of his black loafers.
Which may have been the style at the time. I wasn't wearing them in 94.
No. Though, like, if he pulled them right up, I'm sure they would go like thigh high.
Yeah.
They were that sort of... they were that big. And yeah, Christopher Eccleston. And this was the role that apparently sort of led to his Our Friends in the North casting the following year.
I saw that as well. Because what had he done before this? I think it was just Let Him Have It, wasn't it? And some telly. I can't remember if I'd seen him in Cracker before this or after this, but it was around about the same time.
God, actually, just looking at you right now, you've got a bit of an Ecclestonian vibe.
Big nose and glasses, you mean?
Well, and you're called Chris.
And I'm called Christopher, yeah. Christopher Webbleston.
Well, yeah. No, not a big nose, but just actually, there is a similarity there.
Really?
Yeah. I think he's a good looking chap.
Oh, I'm all right with that.
Yeah, and I actually think he's the most interesting character in this.
Oh, definitely. He certainly has the biggest journey.
He's the one that has the most integrity in a way, because he's the one who's like, yeah, okay, we've done this horrible thing, we've done this crime. I'm kind of walking the talk in a way of how to get through it. Whereas the other two are kind of trying to deny it. And I didn't remember them being quite so unlikable.
I've made a lot of notes about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in the early 90s, it would have been seen as a lot more funny. This was sort of the era of TFI Friday and Loaded magazine, where being obnoxious was great.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Laddish.
Yes. But they are awful
people.
Are
awful. Yeah,
and I think that, for me, that's one of the most satisfying challenges of the whole film, is they are the most unlikable, awful, selfish, cruel people.
Yeah.
But you still care what happens to them.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
You still want to know.
I remember being sort of, you know, crushed by the climax on the first time I watched this. And kind of coming away thinking, oh, Ewan McGregor's character was this lovable rogue.
Yeah, he's not.
But he's not. He's an absolute knob. He reminded me of John Hanna's character in Sliding Doors.
He's John Hanna's little brother.
Yeah, you could do almost like a Quentin Tarantino Vega Brothers project that he was Vincent Vega and Vic Vega. You could do it with these two, like the worst Scottish prats.
The Law Brothers.
I just thought, oh my God, hell would be sitting in a room with these two
guys.
He
is awful, but he gets away with it
because
of the laughing cow grin.
Yeah.
Which he just puts on at just the right moment. You go, squeeze that cheek. Lovely. But he is awful. He is such a twat.
Yeah, he's an absolute twat. Yeah.
But I think, because I heard listened to an interview with John Hodge, and I think the intention was to make them awful.
Yes,
because I think the first draft, it was called Cruelty. It wasn't called Shallow Grave.
Yeah.
So it's clear the intention is these people are awful.
Well, that first scene of them, so there's the three young people, Kerry Fox's character, Juliet, who is a doctor, Christopher Eccleston's character, David, who is an accountant, and Ewan McGregor's character, Alex, who's sort of a young cub journalist.
Yes.
And they all live together in this really lovely apartment in Edinburgh, although most of the film was shot in Glasgow.
It was all shot in Glasgow.
Yeah. They built the apartment, didn't
they? They did. They hired a warehouse because they couldn't afford a studio.
Yeah.
They found it was cheaper to hire a warehouse and build the flat.
Yeah. And most of the budget, I understand, went in the building.
Well, I thought that, but having watched that documentary, Andrew McDonald says, oh, we got this built for $50,000.
Oh, okay.
And they got, I think, $850,000 off film 4.
Yeah.
it's a bargain because the flat is incredible.
It looks great.
It's amazing.
It really works for the sort of the Hitchcockian moments of suspense.
And normally when I watch a film where they've got a big house, I'm going to use Home Alone as an example. You sort of laugh at the fact that like, this house is enormous and there's no way they can afford that. But with this, again, I saw something with Danny Boyle and he said it was completely intentional for a couple of reasons. One, it's easier to move the cameras around if the rooms are bigger. But also, he wanted it to be a flat that you'd be jealous of watching it. So it encourages the greed and the avarice that they also have. Or, as he put it, a flat that you'd be prepared to kill for.
That's interesting because while it was spacious and you know had that really grand sort of spiral staircase in the atrium, it still felt...
The colour scheme, the Edward Hopper colour
There's
scheme.
Something grim about it. So,
I think the colours were meant to be warm, but to me, they make you feel even colder.
Yeah, there was still sort of a believable... You know, like the decor wasn't particularly
funny. Yeah.
But I mean, it's so that first scene, they are interviewing for a fourth flatmate. They torment and torture this chap, Cameron, who's come in, and they mock him to his face.
I find him interesting because not only now we watch him on kids' programs, he's on Wooly and Tig. Plays Daddy on Wooly and Tig.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you'll watch it.
Yeah.
But he's there with his anorak and his Forbidden Planet bag.
Yeah.
You're almost encouraged to sneer at him. He's a little bit geeky, a little bit nerdy. Of course, now he'd be a hipster. Being dressed like that. But, you know, he's almost like a target for this kind of bullying, the way that they've dressed him. And he's very timid and very polite.
And they really interrogate him about this really stupid things. You know, what makes you think you'd be great enough to come and live here with us?
Yeah,
And then as they usher him out the door, this like really over-the-top laughter and just, you know, absolute relishing their kind of psychological torture of this guy. So it's clear from the first scene that these three are arrogant, cruel, superior, elitist twats.
Yeah.
Even though they're all three different, very different sort of archetypes of character. Because apparently the critics were quite divided on this about how cold and calculating the characters were.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it's only critics who care about what characters are like. Audiences don't actually care. They just get swept up in the story.
I don't agree with that. I think audiences still care about characters, but audiences are smart enough to, even if you don't like them, you still give a shit about what happened.
I
thought that was almost like an elitist thing to say. It was like inverted snobbery.
It is a bit, and I agree with you, because it's a real skill of storytelling, isn't it, to have unsympathetic protagonists.
Absolutely.
But, you know, deliberately unsympathetic, but the story still carries you along. I'm thinking of things like Succession. I don't know if you watch Succession.
I haven't, but I know what you mean.
They're all awful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Seinfeld even, they're all awful, but you still care about what happens.
Well, you can relate to them, and that's the difference.
Yeah. There's a really good film that I watched recently, actually, Under the Silver Lake with Andrew Garfield. It's quite polarizing, but one of the criticisms was, oh my God, this guy's so unlikable. And it's like, yes, he's deliberately, you can tell in the film. Yeah. I found it really... I really loved it.
Oh, good.
I could see why people wouldn't. But yeah, he's just a despicable character, and your protagonist doesn't have to be a hero.
But talking about unlikable characters, what I also find interesting about this, and it is a spoiler, is normally when you get characters that you don't like, there's some form of redemption
at
the end. None here.
Yeah.
Absolutely none. They are as awful at the end as they were at the beginning.
Yeah.
Possibly even worse because they turn on each other.
Yeah. At the start, they're just twats, but at the end, they're homicidal twats.
So they demonstrate their twatishness by not only humiliating poor Cameron, they bring Billy Elliot's dad to tears and some other poor people. There's like a sort of a mumsy looking woman and a goth, and they just rip the piss out of them as well. It's kind of almost apparent that they don't actually really want anyone in the fourth room. They just want to humiliate people.
This is sort of entertainment.
And
the goth chick, I'd live with her. She'd look cool.
Yeah, she'd be great fun.
Yeah. I feel like these days she'd be like super desirable.
To be fair, Cameron would have been lovely.
Yeah.
He's lovely.
Yeah, and you find out later in the movie he doesn't take much shit either.
I like Cameron.
He'll fucking beat the shit out of you in a toilet cubicle.
The character arc in this film. Is Cameron.
Yeah.
He stands up for himself.
There is, like, in the shallow grave cinematic universe, there is Cameron, a shallow grave story, which is told from his perspective.
That'd be great. It'd be like Tommy in Coward of the County. All this crawling was bottled up inside it. Not a McGregor was standing.
No.
When he turned and left the toilet.
Yeah. One thing I did read, which sounds interesting, and I hope it's true, is that apparently Danny Boyle insisted on having the three leads live together for a week prior to shooting. Apparently Christopher Eccleston later wrote that the only thing they learned from the experience was that they didn't like each other.
But something he did say about this, I saw an interview with him that was filmed probably a couple of years ago about his experiences on Charlotte Grape, and he said he didn't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And he said that was his own personal insecurities. Mm. He had that feeling, that imposter syndrome, where he didn't think he deserved the role, and he thought, any second now, they're going to fire me. And he said, well, for the film's benefit, that was great, because it led into his insecurities and his anxiety of the character.
Yeah.
But he just said it was an absolutely horrible experience. Well, he just really didn't enjoy it, and nobody looked after him.
Apparently he was... so afraid of getting locked in a real-life mortuary, he had to ask a crew member to stand in the shadows and sort of reassure him and keep him company.
Wow.
Yeah, I think he's written quite a bit about his various sort of anxieties. And
he just needs someone to tell him he's really good.
Yeah, he is really good.
Because he is really good, yeah.
He's my favourite Doctor Who.
Absolutely. I don't really watch Doctor Who, but I watched all of his.
Yeah.
Because I just like him.
Yeah, I don't watch Doctor Who either, but when the revival came back with him in the role... I thought, oh my god, this is a great casting. I love the whole like leather jacket thing.
Absolutely.
That, you know, I watched a few episodes and was like, oh, it's still really ropey special effects and fucking sucks. But I did watch the whole season with him. And then it's the cliche that everyone loves David Tennant as the modern Doctor Who. But I can't bear Doctor Who with the shitty, that kind of glossy sheen, but shitty special effects. And But yeah, I thought he was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's always a really welcome presence.
Absolutely.
Great in 28 Days Later.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So what's your, what are your views on Danny Boyle?
Until recently, I've been a huge fan.
Yeah.
I think I went to the cinema to see every single one of his films, up to and including 127 Hours.
Yeah.
So even things like Millions. It's like Shallow Grave, the kids film.
He's a really funny one, isn't he, Danny Boyle?
You can't pin him down. Right. If you look at various films of his, you can't really identify it's from the same director.
Yeah.
If you look at like 28 Days Later and Sunshine, not only were they the same director, they were the same screenwriter.
Yeah, yeah,
and you think,
yeah.
How is that possible?
Yeah.
But I love the way that he jumps around like that. He's always accused of like sort of style over content, and I don't think that's true.
No.
There's a lot of style. They always talk about his kinetic energy.
Yeah.
But it's very seldom at the expense of the story or the character.
No, I think his style, more often than not, helps propel the story.
Yeah.
And illustrate the themes, and I mean, there are some elements of his that are kind of recurring motifs. You know, his use of music, his kinetic energy, I think, is actually a fair description. But and he is incredibly stylish director, but his projects are so different. I mean, after Trainspotting, I was kind of, oh my god, I love this guy. I'm going to follow everything. I actually really like The Beach.
I do too. Yeah.
Watched it for ages, but I remember like loving it.
Mm.
Love 28 Days Later. It's, haven't seen it for a while, but God, I would just
love it.
So people forget that when it came out, it almost single-handedly revived the whole zombie genre. And then it's at the point now where I'm kind of like, oh, Danny Boyle from I liked Slumdog Millionaire. I saw it at the movies, then, and obviously that was where he won his Oscars and things. And then I watched it again, and I was really underwhelmed with it.
I've only seen it the once. I did really, really like it when I saw it at the cinema, and I haven't seen it since.
127 Hours just didn't interest me.
Because I went the other way. When I saw that at the movies, I really didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I saw it when it was on like TV or something, and I thought, oh, this is great. Mm. I really liked it second time.
I admired him trying to do something like that, but I don't know if I can fucking watch James Franco.
Yeah, that's a problem.
You know, for that long. And then... yeah, some of his other later kind of efforts. I really would have loved to have seen his James Bond.
Yes.
When he was attached to the latest Bond movie, I was really excited about that. And then, obviously, creative differences. And
yeah. Do you think he walked because he didn't want to do the ending that Daniel Craig suggested?
Well, I did read an interview where I'm fairly certain either he is quoted or someone else who was involved when he was attached is quoted as saying that he never would have killed off Bond.
Yeah.
And I have a real big issue with Bond dying in that
movie. Absolutely.
It's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
It pisses me off that throughout the Craig run, he just broke the rules of Bond the whole time.
Yeah. It's a really arrogant way
arrogant. Really. And just unnecessarily depressing. You know, it's supposed to be a fucking thrill ride, not a depressing, sad dude.
It's a shame because the last one was good fun.
It was.
It felt like it was getting back on track.
Yeah, it was. And he was having fun.
Yeah.
And it could have had a lovely, nice, sweet, happy ending, which would have been great.
Yeah.
You know, we want escapism from Bond. We don't want fucking...
realism. Anyway, yeah.
But, I'm at that point now where if a Danny Boyle movie comes out, I'll still kind of have a read about it, but I won't necessarily rush out.
Yeah. I sort of started turning off with Trance.
Yeah.
Which I didn't enjoy at all. The central concept that hypnotism to that level is real... just lost me. And that did seem a bit too showy, you know, there's all the kind of the visual, almost Saw-Bass style visuals and the trippy stuff, and it just lost me.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in Steve Jobs. I might watch Yesterday, just so I don't have to punch myself in the dick for an hour and a half.
I mean, what the fuck? It's like a Richard Curtis film. Why is it a Danny Boyle film? But it should be a Richard Curtis film.
But it annoys, and I want to watch it just to get annoyed, I think. That's the same reason I watch Love Actually, is just to get annoyed. But it just completely misses the point.
Yeah.
To assume that the Beatles were brilliant just because of the songs. Mm. And someone else picking up a guitar and singing, I wanna hold your hand, is going to have the same effect. The original script didn't do that.
Yeah.
The original script, which wasn't written by Richard Curtis, was about the same premise. But when he goes and releases the songs himself, he bombs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's not the Beatles.
Yeah.
And that's a much more interesting idea.
The amazing charisma and personality that they...
But Richard Curtis bought it, changed it just enough to have sole writing credits, turned it into a rom-com, and pissed all over it.
Yeah. And Danny Boyle directed it, though. What the fuck?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do still admire the fact that he kind of seems to, like, go for big swings on different genre and themes and things, but... Yeah, hopefully he does something really gripping and exciting again soon.
Yeah, I think his next one is Methuselah. I'm not sure if that's the real one or just
The world's oldest tortoise or something. It's called Methuselah, isn't it?
I'd watch that.
It's like 127 hours, but with a tortoise.
Got his head stuck in his shell, yeah. But if he does have sort of recurring themes, particularly with his earlier films, and I think this comes from his Catholic upbringing, because he was going to be a priest.
Yeah.
He does like to deal with sort of really ethical dilemmas. And in particular, the protagonists being very much like this. Not particularly nice people or unlikable
flawed, people. Making bad decisions.
You look at this, you look at Trainspotting. It's a bunch of smackheads who beat up Americans and steal their money or glass people in the face. And you love them.
Look at The Beach.
The Beach, absolutely. What a bunch of pricks.
You know, he steals that chap's girlfriend. Yeah. And, you know,
Well, they're just a bunch of entitled pricks. Yeah. We hate tourists, but we're going to live in Thailand on a beach.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But you follow it through.
And 28 Days Later, of course, which is all about, it's not really the infected who are the horrible people. It's
the old adage. It's mankind. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. We're the real monsters.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And I think it's also quite noticeable that Ewan McGregor could have probably starred in virtually all of his first five or six films. It was only because they fell out over The Beach that he didn't, I think.
Yeah.
He could have easily been the Cillian Murphy character in 28 Days Later. Could have played at least two of the characters in Sunshine.
I'm glad he wasn't, because I think Cillian Murphy was...
Oh, he's brilliant.
...was brilliant.
And also happy to get his cock out, which is, of course, a Ewan McGregor trait as well. Yeah. Because he did that in 28 Days Later.
And well, thank God he didn't bring out Keith Allen for for that. and perhaps like in that early phase, a kind of a focus on sort of youth. Not little youth, but that early 20s, mid-20s kind
Absolutely.
Of... Absolutely. And I think that was something that the creative team behind this film were looking at doing as well. That I read that they observed that British film was not telling stories about people in their sort of early mid-20s, and that was something they wanted to look at with this as well.
Yeah, and he does, him and some early sort of Michael Winterbottom films.
Yeah.
And I think they're very, very similar.
Yeah.
I think they've done that very well when they try to, obviously I'm talking about 24 Hour Party. Of course, yes. Winterbottom, which I think is just a masterpiece.
Oh, I love it,
so good. So absolutely love
it. Yeah, God, did you watch Greed?
No. I've gone off Michael Winterbottom as well.
I love Michael Winterbottom, and I love Cock and Bull Story.
Oh, yeah. Things like Wonderland and stuff are amazing.
Yeah, and all his Coogan sort of collaborations. I really love those the trip films. And then, I watched Greed, which, God, it was almost unwatchable. Mm. Terrible. And then, of course, his next film is the Kenneth Branagh as Boris Johnson.
Oh, God, that's him, isn't it?
Can't be fucked watching it, because...
Oh, God, no.
It feels like it's all the really interesting stuff that happened with Boris Johnson happened after what they're showing on...
Yeah, it's bad timing, isn't it?
It is a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anyway, Shallow Grave.
Shallow Grave.
We're still at the interviews at the flat.
I know.
Yeah, or they've just kicked out the people for the interviews. And I suppose the other thing, which the flat represents very well, is that even though these are very professional, very intelligent, most of the time very outgoing people, all they've got is each other.
They
don't have any friends or acquaintances or anything. It's just those three. The only thing that comes close to an acquaintance is Brian, who's this sort of very old doctor who keeps phoning Julieta. But that's it.
Yeah, she's an interesting one, isn't she? That's kind of a hint to her sort of like femme fatale qualities, perhaps, that she kind of has these admirers. What is the situation with her and David? Are they together, or is it only when she sort of manipulates him?
I think it's only when she manipulates him. It's clear from a conversation that they have when they're driving home from an obnoxious squash game.
Yeah.
David clearly is interested in Juliet because Alex Ewan McGregor takes the piss out of him.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anything going on at that point.
Yes, and she very openly flirts with Alex all the
time. Oh, absolutely.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then, of course, the next big thing that happens is after they've said goodbye to the potential flatmates, is a final interviewee turns up at the door when only Juliet is at home.
Yeah.
And it's Hugo, played by Keith Allen.
Keith Allen playing himself.
Playing a toned-down version of himself. I find
much more likable version of himself.
Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah. I find Keith Allen interesting in that when I see him as himself, and I have seen him in real life, can't stand him.
Yeah, okay. But when did you see him in real life?
Well, it's an interesting story, actually. Mm. My wife took me away for my birthday, my 33rd birthday.
Okay.
To a very small coastal town in Devon.
Yep.
And it happened to be the town carnival that weekend. And as part of that town carnival, there was a charity football match between the local team and Fat Les's All-Star 11.
I thought you were almost going to say the local team and Fat Les's. I'm glad you didn't.
Fat Les's All-Star 11.
Okay.
So there was a football match going on between this team and Keith Allen was there. I think Damien Hirst was there.
Oh, wow.
Bez from the Happy Mondays
wow.
was there. Chris Coghill, who played Bez in 24 Hour Body People, was there.
Woo! Inception.
Yeah. Spider from Coronation Street. Big cast. Far yeah, out. I know. And then after that, there was a big party on the beach in the evening on my birthday.
Yeah.
It was a massive beach party. And they were all there having a big laugh.
Damien Hirst didn't preserve any bisected
yeah, he caught a fish and chopped it in half and put it in formaldehyde. Yeah. But then there was a little stage with like some live music and Keith Allen got up and sang Vindaloo.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just seemed really unpleasant and obnoxious.
Yeah, yeah.
But as an actor, I think he's really good. I think he's a very, very good actor.
Yeah. And I'm David Harbour's father-in-law.
That's right. Amazing.
The weirdest...
back to Hopper again, aren't we?
Yeah, the weirdest family celebrity match that you can think of. I always just thought it was so random, Lily Allen and David Harbour marrying.
I always knew, he's married to someone famous, or he's with someone famous, and I can never remember who it was.
Yeah. It's just like a random celebrity couple generator.
Good for him.
Yeah.
So he comes in. He's a different thing altogether. Mm-hmm. He's got this kind of quiet, cool confidence. So he's not like one of these sort of saddos that they've ridiculed in the past.
You get the impression Juliet would shag him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she finds him interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They have a little chat and he's really cool. He says, I'm writing a book and all this sort of stuff. And he makes little jokes about, he doesn't know what it's about. And she gives him a test and gets him to answer the phone to Brian and he does it perfectly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's quite good. That's good.
So they get him around for dinner just to give him one sort of final interview so the other two can meet him. And obviously, Ewan McGregor acts like a total arsehole.
Yeah.
He gets drunk and he's making loads of noise and loads of nonsense. And I think the test is to see if he'll put up with their arsehole-ish behaviour. Yeah. And you can tell he doesn't put up with that sort of shit.
Yeah.
So he's in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a nice cut to show that something unpleasant is going to happen.
Mm.
Because David says to him, have you ever killed a man?
Yeah.
And then it cuts to this awful mugging at an ATM.
Which is great because it's the POV of the ATM.
Yeah.
And it looks really cheap and simple how they've done it.
Oh, completely, yeah.
It's really effective.
It's really effective, yeah. Mm. So these two, Peter Mullen and someone else, play these baddies. And we know nothing about them at all.
No.
And all we see is this guy trying to get money out of an ATM and they smash his head against the ATM until blood is running down the screen.
Yeah.
And this is intercut with them talking to Hugo.
Yeah. So you know that he's linked somehow to this dark underworld.
Something's going on.
Mm-hmm. And apparently Danny Boyle was warned not to work with Keith Allen. But he loved him, apparently.
Yeah, they got on very well. Mm. I mean, he's used him again.
Yeah.
Obviously, he used him in Trainspotting.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He played the same character.
I don't believe that.
Well...
Danny Boyle's joked about it and said, wouldn't it be funny? Okay. But that only works if Ewan McGregor's still playing Renton and Peter Mullen's still playing Mother Superior. It doesn't really work. That's a bit fanboy for me. Yeah,
Kevin Smith would buy it. Kevin Smith would argue that you could do that. Far be it from me to...
I don't like Kevin
Smith. Yeah, I know, me either.
It's a lovely idea.
It's a lovely idea.
And again, it does go into Hugo, a shallow grave story.
Yeah.
Or a Trainspotting story. I just think it's too cute.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway.
It's like the 13th Warrior. But it's like Hugo is sort of like the Antonio Banderas character. There's another 13th Warrior.
There is.
In this.
There is.
Yes,
yeah.
We'll get there.
There is. I know. I'm glad you spotted it. So Hugo moves in. He goes into his surprisingly dark room. Compared to everybody else's. All the walls are painted in these like burnt orange and these like nice blues. And his just seems black.
Yeah.
So they should have let the goth move in.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later, nobody seems to have seen Hugo.
No.
His car's parked outside, so he must be somewhere around. So rather than sort of genuinely show any concern, they just bang on his door and giggle a lot.
Yeah.
And Alex is shouting, oh, we're your new friends and companions, and all sort of nonsense. But they realise the door's been locked from the inside, so he's in there. So eventually, they all sort of burst in. They all kind of burst in together, which is a great shot. It's a shot for the trailer.
Yeah.
And he's dead on the bed.
Well, there's Wang out.
Because it's Keith Allen.
Yeah. It's not a pleasant sight.
No. I always thought he died of an accidental overdose. But I saw a Danny Boyle interview, and he specifically says it was suicide, which doesn't make sense
to me.
So
a deliberate overdose?
Yeah.
Is it because he knows these horrible guys are going to catch up
with him? Well, why move into a flat with £1 million? Why not just run away with £1 million?
Why not go to Rio de Janeiro?
Yeah. I thought he was just hiding out, like on the lam.
Yeah. It certainly doesn't come across that way, that he's deliberately
No, I don't think
it,
so either. But that's how Danny Boyle sort of saw it. I watched a couple
He's fucking with us, Danny Boyle.
Yeah, he is actually, yeah. He's the guy from Trainspotting, and he committed suicide. Yeah. What does he know? He's only the director.
Yeah.
So because Alex is a prick, he starts going through his stuff, and he finds immediately starts going through his
Juliet's
stuff.
Juliet's quite perturbed about him doing that.
Of course, yeah, because she's a doctor.
Yes.
She's not very happy. David does say a very, very funny line where he says, you know, I've never seen a dead body before. He says, you know, I saw my grandmother, but I don't suppose that counts because she was alive at the time.
That's really good.
So funny. So Juliet is about to call it in, but Alex stops her because he's opened one of the suitcases and he shows her what's inside.
Mm.
And of course, it's a suitcase full of cash. And that is real money.
Yeah.
It's £1 million.
Yeah,
They hired
£1 million.
Where can you hire? I want to go and hire some money.
I know.
Can I hire £1 million, please? Yes, here you go.
Maybe you
bring it back tomorrow.
Maybe you can hire it from a bank.
Yeah, but that creates its own Hugo-style dilemma. Do you just run away with it?
Do you have to, like, sign things where you're like, you know, I promise not to wallow on this naked on a bed.
I promise not to drip blood on it.
Yeah, I promise not to wipe my ass with it.
Well, I assume it comes with a security guard who's standing just off camera.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I didn't know you could just go and hire money.
Maybe you can do that if you're a film production crew.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah. But I thought it was very interesting. It cost me like £1,000 to hire £1 million. That's brilliant.
Capitalism, baby.
Oh, God, the return on that is superb.
Yeah.
So, of course, they discuss what to do with it. It's that age-old dilemma, the Sierra Madre dilemma.
Yes.
Or is it the Pardoner's Tale dilemma?
Yes.
From Canterbury Tales. And, of course, there are other Canterbury Tales called The Miller's Tale.
Yes.
And there's one with Law in the title.
Mm-hmm.
So John Hodge knows what he's doing.
He does.
But they discuss whether to keep it. David and Juliet both say no. But of course, Alex being Alex, he's keen to keep the money.
Yep.
And, you know, don't say you're not tempted.
Yep.
Go and phone the police and say there's a big suitcase of money and you don't want it.
Yeah.
He is charming.
Apparently.
Well, yeah. But then we get a nice little montage of showing how sort of humdrum their lives are. We see Alex at the newspaper. People clearly don't like him there either. Juliet's a little bit bored at hospital and
David appears to be working at an accountant's firm from the 1940s.
Yeah. With a sort of little library room with telephones and stuff.
Yeah.
I did like when David's talking to his manager and his manager basically says that chartered accountants are sneered at and he basically says he's a good accountant because he's boring.
Yeah.
You know, I work with chartered accountants every day, so I can't possibly comment. But because David takes a look around at his life, and he just looks at her and goes, well, let's do it.
Yeah.
They're in. All three of them are in. So we're straight to B&Q. I like this scene.
Yeah.
I like this scene very much. Alex is gleefully instructing what tools they need so they can remove all the recognisable features, the hands, the feet, the teeth.
Yeah.
So they're buying hacksaws, hammers, shovel.
Yeah.
The usual stuff for disposal. And that's when David asks the important question that nobody really wants to ask is who's going to do it? Who is going to remove these parts of the body? So Alex very sort of confidently says, well, we'll all do it. So everyone's involved, everyone's hands are dirty. David, of course, because he's the timid one, says he won't be able to. And they kind of look at him and treat him like he's weak. He's not able to do it.
I actually felt my heart went out to him when he said that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what's going to happen.
Yeah, you do.
As soon as someone goes, I can't do this, you know what's going to happen.
It's interesting, is that the kind of archetypes that they've fit. So David is clearly the straight-laced, always done everything right.
Yes.
Reserved.
Yeah, there's a reason his job is an accountant.
Yeah.
It's because everything's by the book.
And Alex is the brash, kind of loud, roguish, full of bravado, but he's actually the one without any guts. And he's a bully.
He's a complete and utter bully, yeah. Another good line is where Juliet says she's not sure if she can do it either, and he says, but you're a doctor, you kill people every day.
Yeah, that's good. It's brilliant. That's really good.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Because, of course, John Hodge wrote this while he was a junior doctor.
Yes.
How did he find time to write a screenplay when he's a junior doctor?
Mustn't have had kids.
No. Again, listen to an interview with him. He was asking, what did you learn from making this film?
Mm.
And he said he didn't really learn anything because it was ridiculously easy to get the film funded.
Yeah.
So he learned nothing.
Yeah.
He learned nothing about the 27th draft or getting films turned down or conflicts with the studio.
Yeah.
He basically took the script to Andrew McDonald.
Yeah.
Andrew McDonald said, I want to produce this.
Well, it's a fucking great script.
It is a fucking great script.
Yeah.
They took it to the Edinburgh Film Festival.
Yeah.
They gave them development funding, like 150 grand.
Mm.
They took it to Film 4. They went, here's 850 grand. Go and make it.
Yeah.
And that was it. So no challenges whatsoever.
No.
And he said it was only on about his second or third film, or when scripts started getting turned down, that he realised what a challenge it actually was.
Yeah. It is a really tight, good script, but you can see how in a different filmmaker's hands it could be incredibly pedestrian and predictable.
Oh yeah.
It could
yeah.
just be almost like a little Twilight Zone-y tall tales of the unexpected.
Oh absolutely.
Kind of thing. And watching it again, I was struck by how kind of predictable it is. And I mean, yes, it's predictable because I've seen it and I know what happens.
Mm.
But also because this whole, like the films you've alluded to, the heist goes wrong where they all kind of turn on each other. And,
yeah.
You know, it is such a trope. But there is something really compelling about watching these three incredibly close friends.
And that's how he wrote it. He first wrote it. What he wanted to do was write a screenplay about people who share a flat together. Because he'd known from his flat sharing days that on a lot of occasions, if you've got three people living together, they love each other, they're brilliant, but there are times where they absolutely hate each other.
Yeah.
And he wanted to focus on that. And he thought, well,
and you'll always get occasions where two will gang up on one.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So he liked that dynamic.
Yeah.
And he thought, well, what would be the most obvious thing to cause them to fall out? Money.
Or someone not doing the dishes on their night.
Absolutely, or taking the last sausage out of the fridge.
Far less cinematic. Like
yeah, eating my cornflakes. And he worked it back from there. He looked at things like Treasure on Sierra Madre. He'd recently watched Blood Simple.
Mm.
And what he did, I think, was really smart. He knew the limitations of a first screenplay.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew it could only ever be made on a budget.
Yeah.
So he minimised the characters
mm-hmm.
and the settings as much as he possibly could.
Mm.
It's practically a stage play. I think it has been made as a stage play.
Yeah.
And that's really smart. If you want to get something made, you don't set it in space. You don't have 100 characters and 20 locations.
Yeah.
You have one location, you have three characters, and that's it.
But it thematically works
absolutely
really well.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it just adds to the whole sort of Hitchcockian sort of suspense.
Oh, definitely. And like you mentioned Rope, it never occurred to me. I'm similar in sort of theme and setting it is to Rope. So, while they're wrapping the body in Hugo's room, it's then again nicely intercut, very much like when he's questioning Hugo before.
Mm.
He says something about, do you think Hugo's going to be missed? Do you think anyone knows where he is?
Mm.
And it cuts straight away to these baddies torturing someone, saying, where is he? Where is he?
Shoving his head in a bath.
It's horrible.
Did you read that apparently they were trying to audition good swimmers?
Yes.
And so the actor who got the part, he's never worked in film again.
It was Duncan Goodhue.
And basically his whole role is just getting waterboarded or just drowned.
They don't have to do that to him all day. You don't need a good swimmer, you just need someone who can hold their breath. But yeah, it's a very, very unpleasant torture scene. You see this close-up of his face in blood red water.
Yeah.
It's very traumatic. It sets that scene of something really awful is coming.
Yeah.
And you get this feeling of dread.
Yeah.
They've got this money, but they're coming for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though you said, you know, that the script is kind of very predictable, you know where it's going.
Mm.
What I really like is the misdirection of these two baddies.
Yeah, yeah.
You think they're going to be the climax
antagonist
of the film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the reason that they're not, first time, is so shocking, which we'll get to.
Yes.
Of course, as you said, Alex changes the rules.
Mm.
So to reduce the chances of him actually having to do anything, he says, well, all right, let's draw straws.
Yeah.
Whoever gets the short straw does everything.
Yeah.
And of course,
David gets the short straw.
David gets the short straw. And then we cut to some really unpleasant sound effects.
Yeah. And so he's got a hacksaw sawing off the hands and feet.
Yes.
And he's retching at the same time. And there's a saliva kind of like, he's coughing saliva. And
it's all silhouette, but you can see how sort of panicked he is by doing this. Like he's being driven mad by it.
Yeah.
And this very bright, very Goodfellas Billy Bat style red light.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's horrible.
That's
and then
horrific.
It gets worse.
Yeah.
Because he picks up the hammer. Because, of course, he has to destroy the facial features and the dental records.
Mm.
I remember watching that first time round,
yeah,
and just going, oh my god.
Yeah.
I was with my girlfriend, she was like hiding her eyes.
Yeah.
She didn't enjoy the film at all.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
We're not together anymore.
It's really dark. And he comes out changed, doesn't he?
He does. Because then we see, and this is a motif that they use at the beginning of the film as well, is a shot of David lying on his back, staring at the ceiling with the camera slowly rotating.
Looking very gaunt and sort of dark rings
being
under his eyes.
Being haunted at what he's done. So the face slowly rotates. Yeah. He doesn't move, he's just staring upwards.
Yeah.
And that happens at the start of the film as well. The body has been buried.
Mm. In a deep grave?
I don't think it's a deep grave.
No?
Well, not especially deep.
No. Right.
They don't say it, which is good.
Yeah.
I like that. They don't go, welcome to shallow grave.
Yeah. We've dug a shallow grave.
So with the body buried, because they didn't have to do anything at all, Alex and Juliet, they're fine.
Yeah.
So Alex is watching Chris Tarrant lose a million. Which was a real thing.
Yeah. I was listening to Chris Tarrant's sort of intro to that because I'd never heard of Lose a Million before and it was sort of,
it was awful. It seemed good.
The objective is to lose a million.
But he always the thing where he insults the audience and then goes a catchphrase.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Michael Sheen.
Yeah. I wouldn't do a joke like that on Owen Glyndwr Day. So Alex is doing the catchphrases. He's laughing, doing the smile. Everything's okay in Alex's world.
Yeah.
And while he's doing that, David's hiding the money in the loft. Mm. He sort of wrapped it and he puts it in the big water tank, the big immersion tank in the loft.
And he's gotten very sort of insular.
Yeah, the paranoia is kicking in.
Mm.
And then we see a nice shot of Juliet at the hospital, just putting the hands and feet in the incinerator trolley.
Yeah.
Which is good. And then it's the medical fundraiser.
Yeah.
Big country dancing. Extras.
Yeah. Yes.
There's a funny scene in that documentary where they're casting all of the extras. Because there's only one scene where there's other people in it.
Yeah.
And it's this one. And there's like about 200 people. And you can see people like lining up and being interviewed by the casting director. And they're all like, yeah, I played a judge in Taggart. I was in... all these Scottish things. Yeah. And they just go... Can you dance to Strip the Willow? Yes, I can. I can learn that, yes.
Excellent.
Alex, of course, is acting like a twat.
He's just an absolute...
He's heckling the speeches. Being
fucking
an
twat.
Yep, absolute bell end. So him and Juliet are having a lovely time. David is, of course, on his own. They go to Strip the Willow, and David's this up by himself. And they do this thing where he goes out of control and lands on the floor.
Yeah.
He does the big laugh.
Yeah.
And she then, interestingly, she kind of puts her shoe on his chest.
Yes.
Which is kind of portentous.
Yeah.
And he sort of slobbers on it.
Yeah.
Which is that.
It's like, kind of gross.
It is gross, but is that meant to suggest that they are potentially an item and they're closer than they are to David?
Yeah.
Because he kisses her shoe.
Towards the climax, it's very clear that Alex actually, he does something which
yes, is
uncharacteristically courageous.
Yes.
Which suggests
absolutely
that he,
right, yeah.
Yeah, he actually loves her.
The one good thing that he does, that's his only sort of little bit of redemption.
Yeah.
And while they're dancing, we get another cut to the baddies.
Mm.
If you thought the bath scene was bad,
they
are now torturing some guy by putting him in the freezer until he's virtually dead. They get him out again and he whispers an address to them.
Yeah.
And they thank
him. That's a rough one, isn't it? That's quite creative.
Yeah, it is. It's not as creative as what they do next, though, which is, you know, they kind of thank him by putting him back in the freezer, closing the lid, and putting a load of very heavy sort of grow bags on top so he can't get out. And the lid's transparent.
And you can
see him like banging on the freezer. That one troubled me.
Yeah.
And Alex sees Cameron gleefully selling roses.
Yeah.
And of course, they can't resist another opportunity just to humiliate him again.
They beckon him over.
And go, oh, sorry.
As we thought you were someone else. Yeah.
And then he shouts that good luck thing back at him again, which is, of course, what he shouted when he shooed him out of the flat. And then David's about to sort of discuss what they're going to do next as far as the money goes. He's trying to do it very, very seriously when he's interrupted by Brian, who's, of course, the persistent phone caller.
Yes.
Who's this doctor who looks about
middle-aged.
Yeah. David doesn't respond that well to being interrupted. He says what you said.
Yeah,
at the
he does that intimidating rant.
Call 3 weeks in advance, or you'll end up in a fucking bin bag.
Yeah.
So Brian goes away, but they love it.
Yeah.
They think it's great that David has finally stood up to somebody.
Yeah.
By acting like a psycho.
And Juliet, sort of, you can see she's kind of concerned, but also kind of impressed.
Yeah.
You can see that she has a dawning awareness that something's not quite right with David.
Yeah. And it is pretty obvious because he's very, very quiet, more insular than usual.
Mm.
But as luck would have it, when Alex goes to the toilet then, Cameron beats the shit out of him. Quite right too.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
His first unpleasant experience in a Danny Boyle toilet. Yeah.
And then we're on to the next morning, and Alex is battered and bruised, and he's in a right moody. So him and Juliet decide to go and spend some money. And we get this sort of...
on a giant camcorder.
They're sort of laughing heartily and very over the top, very much like in that first scene by the door.
Yeah.
While they're watching sort of home videos of sort of toys and dolls and this really impressive pair of checkered trousers that Alex seems to be wearing. I have to say, he does look very striking in that dress with the makeup on. It's that hair.
Did you notice the big mistake in this montage?
Oh, no, no, no.
So there's a scene in the little home video that they make of them in the bathtub. They have got the big giant camcorder in the camera in the bathtub with them.
Oh, I see. Maybe they bought two. Wow. I prefer to accept that.
Well, David will be fucking furious when he finds out about the second one.
Absolutely. Because so David comes home and he's slightly upset that they're taking everything so lightly.
Yeah.
And again, he comes up with possibly the most important line in the film, where he's asking how much the camcorder cost, and Alex is being a twat and saying, I don't know, I can't remember, I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah.
And Juliet says £500.
Doesn't he say that's how much he spent, but we don't know how much it's
cost us. We don't know what it's cost us yet. That's what you paid for it, but we don't know how much it's cost us.
Yeah.
It's a good line.
That is a good line, yeah.
And it doesn't sound kind of cheesy or stilted.
Yeah.
It works.
You know, David is really the one who has... he's the one who steered into the abyss. He's accepted that they've transgressed. They've crossed this line of acceptable, this boundary.
Yeah.
And now if they're actually going to do this, they have to actually operate in a ruthless, criminal, dark way.
Absolutely.
Now.
And he is also saying, you think this is over.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not. I don't know how, but it's definitely not over.
Yeah, yeah. Or just, we have to be fucking careful, you twats.
Yeah, yeah. And then David says he wants to secure the money, but they're kind of pushing him to enjoy himself more. And then Alex says, you don't know the joy of spending.
Yeah.
I didn't do it just to hide the money away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
David just kills the mood dead by saying, and you didn't saw his feet off.
No. And he's a fucking chartered accountant.
Exactly. So, lecture him on money. Yeah. God's sake. That's how he can afford to live in that flat. Yeah. He's an accountant. But if we didn't think that David's paranoia was bad, he's now sleeping in the loft.
Yeah.
He's got a little mattress up there.
Yeah.
And he's sleeping in the loft and he's sort of hopping around between the beams, almost like an animal. Sort of hopping around like a monkey.
Sort of turning into Brundlefly almost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For an accountant.
Yeah.
It's quite an alarming transformation. Yeah. And that's when Alex and Juliet start beginning to plot to take the money from him.
Yeah.
Partly because of David's paranoia, but also because they're awful people.
He's drilled holes in the ceiling too.
He does,
so he can see what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, because when Alex is watching The Wicker Man, just drilling holes.
Yeah, that was interesting, actually. That was quite just added to the unsettling kind of vibe of the film, hearing Edward Woodward go, oh my God, Jesus Christ!
A frightened Scotsman.
Still fucking sends shivers down my spine.
Absolutely, And then there's someone at the door. And the baddies burst in.
Yep.
They tie Alex and Juliet up. They get a crowbar. And they hit Alex on the shins with the crowbar.
Yeah.
That's going to hurt.
That's really going to hurt.
I used to play football, and if I ever got kicked in the leg, we bang it on the table.
Lucky he had his big white fluffy socks.
Otherwise, it's going to be some real damage.
It's the only thing between him and a broken shin.
So the baddies are there, and it's not going to end well, clearly. Because we've seen what they can do. There's no mercy. They'll just kill anyone to get this money. And meanwhile, we just see David very calmly close the hatch because he's in the loft as well.
Yeah.
So the baddie, who's not Peter Mullen, goes up there and we hear a thud. So Peter Mullen goes up to check. And then while he's up there in the darkness with, you know, the traditional flickering light bulb, we see a very quick shot of David behind him and hear another thud. And then the bodies both just fall through the hatch. Yeah. The baddies have been killed.
He's almost shot like a stalker and a slasher, David, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's almost Michael Myers, almost kind of.
Yeah, the way he's lit up there, and it's good because it's a loft. You know, you see only half of his face, so it's half darkness, half light. And he does look really chilling and cold.
Yeah.
And so David then jumps after them straight down the hatch. And again, he does that sort of squat like a wild animal. And he sort of checks for markings on their body with his bloody knife. And they've got tattoos. Like I said, I think that's a really good piece of misdirection because you think the baddies are going to be the end thing in this film and he just kills them like that.
And they've built these guys up as being incredibly dangerous and then you realise
he's worse.
Yeah.
We realise the real danger is, of course, each other.
Yeah.
Which then cuts to more grim shots of David sawing in the woods.
Yeah, really frenetic.
Yeah.
Frenzied sawing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really violent film, but so much of it is just implied.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's not
yeah.
a lot of gore. There's not a lot of, you know.
No. The most violent bit is at the end.
Yeah.
And that's to be expected.
Yeah. And even that's not that bad.
No, it's quite cartoony.
Yeah.
You can see the latex.
You can.
But that's all right. Then we're off to the travel agent.
Hey!
And Weath the musician from the Sinister yeah. Warrior.
Scottish-Irish Viking.
Yeah. From the tunnels down there. He sells Juliet a one-way ticket to Rio.
He does,
which
yeah.
is, of course, the stereotypical place people go when they want to run away. They go to Rio.
She's hoping that she'd catch up with Ronnie Biggs.
Yeah.
She is, yeah.
He's still going loco down in Acapulco. So that's when Juliet is kind of working her charms as well. Mm. She tries to get Alex to go up into the loft, yeah. either to get the money or to try and reason with David.
Yeah.
And Alex quite rightly says, you know, did you see what happened to the last two?
Yeah,
They went up there, they went up alive and they came down dead.
And you get the impression that, well, if he dies, she's okay with that too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's one less opponent she has to contend with.
Absolutely. Yeah. He doesn't want it, but she very, very easily massages his ego by saying that you're smarter than him.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes, oh, I'll do it then.
Yeah, I've always thought I was smarter than him. Yeah.
And that's when Ken, Stott and John Hodge arrive.
Mick Columbo.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's a joke.
Yeah.
He's called Inspector McCall. Is it an Inspector McCall's? As in Jamie Priestley.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I thought.
Or unless it's an Edward Woodward equaliser.
He's an equaliser. Don't hurt but, the girl. It's the world's crappiest impression. That's so brilliant.
I love your equaliser. I want that to be on your headstone when you...
Don't hurt the girl.
The girl.
Terrible.
And who would have thought, a role originated by Edward Woodward would eventually go to Denzel Washington and Queen Latifah. Yeah.
That's progress. No,
that is progress.
That's diversity.
That is.
I like that.
But yeah, he just looks so much like Columbo. I think
He does, actually. And I like Ken Stott, whatever he's in. He's really good.
D.I. Rebus.
Yes.
Valen, the dwarf. In the Hobbit trilogy.
And whatever his name was in Taking Over the Asylum, where he played the DJ in the mental institution, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
Loved that. So, they're asking about the burglary downstairs. They interview David, and they're making reference to, also, there's four people that live in this flat. David kind of gives himself away a bit by constantly saying, who said there's four? Who said there's four?
How did they find out about the four? Because I did miss that.
Well, maybe somebody downstairs had said, oh, there's four because another guy has moved in.
Or they're just setting a trap.
Maybe they're setting a trap. Yeah, because he tries that later. He tries setting a trap.
Yeah.
But it shows David's absolute paranoia.
Yeah.
Because by him saying, who said this four, really means he suspects the other two.
It's a red flag. Yeah.
He thinks the other two have gone to the police. Because he does say to Alex then, your friends were here earlier.
Meaning
the police. So he's already suspecting that Alex has told.
Yeah. Which you might expect because Alex is a lily-livered little yellow-bellied little coward.
He is, absolutely right. But he does a little bit of bravery. He does go into the loft.
Yes.
Very good use of light.
Mm.
The light shining through those drilled holes. It looks so good.
Yeah, it does.
It looks brilliant. But while he's up there, David's downstairs.
Mm.
He grabs Juliet and Alex sees the case in the tank.
Yeah.
But when he goes down, he sees that David's got Juliet.
Mm.
And David kind of holds a drill to his face and does a little piercing in his forehead.
Yeah.
A little dink.
There's a little dot.
It's quite unpleasant.
It is, yeah.
Holding the drill to your face. And that's when Juliet kind of turns her attentions to David. Mm. Alex goes to work and Juliet snuggles up to David and says, surely we can sort everything out.
Mm.
And they have a bit of a cuddle.
Yeah. I think she spots the fact that he's so unhinged that he's probably easier to manipulate.
But then Alex is given a story to cover in the newspaper. And of course, there's three unidentified mutilated bodies found in a not deep grave in the woods because he didn't dig deep enough.
No. A little bit of suspension of disbelief there, but the fact that he'd be assigned that. But
you need
a bit coincidental,
you need an interesting way to show that the bodies have been found. And it does work.
Yeah.
It does work. So when he's got home, he's got loads of copies of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Triple corpse horror or something like that. Or triple body horror. Juliet sort of makes it clear that she's on David's side.
Mm. And she's almost coming across as a bit unhinged.
Yeah, they're sort of sitting calmly next to each other unhinged. And they're incredibly calm.
Yeah.
But the police are back. So they show Juliet and Alex photos of Hugo and the other two baddies.
Yeah.
And of course they say they've never seen them before in their lives.
Yeah.
And this is where he tries to trap Alex
and
says, well, how would you react if I said that their car's parked outside now?
I suppose I'd be a bit surprised.
Yeah. So he's just gauging his reaction.
Yeah.
Good police work from Mick Columbo.
Yeah.
Very good. And then we get this quick shot of Alex tearing up copies of his newspaper.
Yeah.
We don't really understand why. And it's just so quick like that, you think nothing of it.
Yeah.
And then we sort of get the final night.
Yes.
Alex has had enough. He gets up to phone the police.
Yeah.
David interrupts and kind of pulls the phone away. He's hiding behind a door and David yanks the phone away. And David's got the case. And he says he's going to leave by himself. Juliet stops him and says, let's go together.
Yeah.
And Alex, he's not fighting for it. He says, that's fine, just go.
Yeah,
fine,
yeah.
You, just go, I don't mind, off you go.
Mm.
And that's when David pulls out the Rio ticket.
Yeah.
And says, you know, you were planning to rip us both off. You were going to take the money and go. And that's when he said Alex does his little bit of valiance.
Because he punches.
Well, first of all, he says, I've got a ticket as well.
Yeah, I bought it.
We're leaving together.
Yeah, he says, I bought it, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, I bought it. I've got one too.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're actually leaving together.
Yeah.
He says, well, David, just go by yourself.
Yeah.
And David's about to go and Juliet blocks his way.
Yeah.
And so he punches her really hard.
It's a nasty punch.
It's very unpleasant. And again, that's where Alex goes, you shouldn't have hit her.
Yeah.
And jumps on his back and they have a big fight.
And I thought that line was a bit much where he says, you could have done anything you want, but you can't hit her. Yeah. It was a little bit, okay.
Yeah. Who knows what you'd say under those circumstances.
Yeah, I just don't think you needed it. Yeah. Him actually reacting that way was enough to say, actually.
Yeah.
That was the Rubicon for him.
Yeah. I suppose technically it's a way of suggesting that he's doing it to protect her rather than he's trying to fight him so he can get the money.
Yeah, okay.
It is a little bit on the nose.
Yeah, it was a little very different.
It's like a child saying.
It was a little, don't hit her.
Yeah. So they have a fight. Again, you probably read this as well. Is that they had to do their own stunts.
Yeah.
Because the stuntman walked because they didn't have enough money to pay him. Mm. They actually had to sell loads of the furniture
so they
could finish the film.
They auctioned off the props.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last scene that they filmed was the police interviews in the flat.
Mm.
And they had to film it in a certain way that you couldn't see any of the other furniture.
Sold off the fridge.
Because they sold it all off.
Yeah.
Just to finish the movie. Yeah. But there is a fridge still left in this scene. Because Alex slams David head.
Yeah.
Very much like Bottom.
Yeah.
Now, a frying pan to come out.
That would have been some casting. Well, we got Keith Allen in there. They could have had
this was Richard
kind of real comic strip. Sort
awesome.
Of
awesome. Because it could make a comedy, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It is funny. But David being mad, he pins Alex down, literally, because he gets the big horror film knife off the table and puts it through Alex's shoulder into the floor. So Alex is pinned to the floor.
And just the music. And yeah, it looks a little bit not entirely photorealistic.
Because clearly he's under the floorboards and it's a latex body.
Just the way that the music ramps up and you see the actual knife plunge into Ewan McGregor. And the look of shock and horror on Ewan McGregor's face. That is such a powerful little...
Because normally when a threat like this is done in slow motion, it's to allow someone to stop
him. Yeah.
It's allows someone to fight back or roll away.
Yeah.
But no, we see him get the knife very slowly and stab him right through the shoulder.
Because again, it's another threshold to cross. It's like, okay, I've killed these other bad guys, but now I'm going to kill
my friend.
Yeah.
So he's pinned him to the floor. He then grabs another knife and finish the job.
He was going to do the other shoulder, I thought. So he's going to even him up. And then...
then carve him.
Yeah, and then like pack sore off the head or something, I don't know.
Like a frog in high school, he's just going to dissect him.
Yeah.
But no, he's about to finish the job off, but Juliet has managed to get up and she puts a knife through the back of David's neck, pops out of his throat.
Oh.
Horrible.
Yeah.
I saw how that was done in the documentary. It's very good.
Yeah,
it's very
it good. Looks great. It actually looks really good.
Yeah, it's a really good effect.
And it's surprising.
Yeah. And so he falls down dead.
Yeah.
Great. Alex and Juliet are safe. And so you think she's going to save Alex.
Mm.
No.
No.
Instead, she twists the blade, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
She turns the knife and presses it deeper into his shoulder. And then as a little callback to the party, she takes her shoe off. Hammers the knife deeper into the floorboards.
A bit much, but
it's to stop him getting up and running after her, isn't it? It's pinning him to the floor.
Yeah,
and she leaves with the case.
Yeah,
she's gone.
Off to Rio.
She's clearly got the money. Off to Rio.
Yeah.
And then it immediately cuts to hours later, next morning, whatever, where Alex is being photographed at the crime scene, still pinned to the floor.
I feel like they possibly would have got him some medical attention before they.
Yeah.
Just sort of walked around him coldly taking photos of him. Did they think he was dead?
Well, that's the thing. Apparently, in post, they reshot him going, hello, Inspector, just to emphasise that he's not dead.
I would have thought him sort of blinking and moving would have indicated that he was alive. But
it could have, because first of all, I thought,
American audience
is it
probably
like a fantasy scene or something like that? Yeah. Is he a ghost?
Yeah,
because anything can happen in a Danny Boyle.
But it's
film.
Kind of it's darkly comic, isn't it?
Very much so. Yeah,
waking
yeah.
up, with
yeah.
getting like a crime scene yeah. photograph.
So he sort of says, "Oh, good morning, Inspector," while they're all yeah. taking photos of him and stuff.
Yeah,
and then we cut to the airport, and Juliet is in her car.
Oh,
really
God.
Disturbing the way that she's screaming.
The scene. This was the scene that just shook me to the bones when I was watched this all those years ago. Yeah, she does such a great, truthful performance of just someone utterly distraught.
Yeah.
We've all felt having a big cry in our cars over something, but I mean,
and until you know why,
yeah.
you think, what the hell is going on? It didn't occur to me.
Yeah, and pans over to the bag of cash and it's all those front pages of
all those torn newspapers,
three corpses
with one £50 note sort of taped to the top of it, and she's got no choice but to leave the country with 50 quid
and be thought of as a murderer.
She can't go back,
and just even the walk, she has a fucked off
walk
to the airport sort of check out,
just storming through.
It's really, that's good acting.
It leaves her with nothing.
And
then we just get this one final shot of Alex, still alive, still pinned to the floor.
Yeah.
And we sort of pan down past him through the floorboards, and the money
and
is hidden
he
under
the floor.
He starts
laughing, though, doesn't he?
He does start laughing, He's got away with it. And the worst of them.
Yeah, and he is actually smarter than David, perhaps.
Yeah.
He's outsmarted them.
He is. He outsmarted both of them.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's why he was saying, just go.
Because
him and Juliet could have had the money between them.
Yeah. So do you think that was his plan, that he and Juliet kept the money? Because the defences that he sort of mounts for her in that last battle would indicate that
there's clearly something between them. Even when she's with David, she goes into his room and she leaves this little, it's like an eraser with the word love on it next to him.
Yeah.
So there's clearly a bigger bond for those two.
Yeah.
So, yeah, possibly that was the idea, just getting David to go.
Yeah.
And they would keep the money.
Yeah.
And then, as we've seen throughout the film, that motif of that rotating David's face with the voiceover talking about friendship and stuff like that, we get one final shot of that, of him looking up at the ceiling, and we realise that all the while, it's his body in the morgue.
Lying on a slab.
Yeah, staring, eyes open.
You see the little cut in his throat.
Yep.
And
he's finally put away into the morgue. And then as the credits roll, we get Happy Heart by Andy Williams.
Yeah, over that slow-mo of them laughing at the door.
Yeah,
which
is a perfect shot to end
the film.
Oh,
and that really chilled me as well. I remember watching it, and then stopping it and looking at my friend and my girlfriend at the time. All right. Should we go to bed? All right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, fucking all right. No one's going to kill each other tonight, are we?
And that's how the film ends.
Yeah. Mm. So, Chris, Wibbleston. Is Shallow Grave still any good?
It is superb. It is so brilliant. Yeah. I thought it would have aged in a number of ways. Like I said, because, you know, Danny Boyle is sometimes seen as a little bit showy, I thought that would have dated. But there's only a small bit of that with sort of the fisheye lens, speeded up traffic at the beginning and stuff. Other than that,
that was fine.
It's fine. I think the script is excellent. I think it's really tight. It's got that really lovely twist with what happens to the drug dealers halfway through the film. I think it's a really good exploration of trust and friendship and greed, all of that stuff. I think the performances are all first rate. If you want, like, the four key people, if we're including Keith Allen in it, are really, really brilliant. Even though Keith Allen's in it for like about 2 minutes of screen time and then another 1 minute of cock time, he has a hold over the entire film.
It's a great cameo, really, isn't
it? It is
a
really good
fantastic cameo.
Because you think at the time he was probably the most famous one out of all four.
Yeah,
that's hard to believe now, but he was. He was the biggest face out of all of them. So, yeah, I think it's just an exceptionally good film. It's funny, it's scary, it's unpleasant. Very, very well directed.
Yeah.
Very, very well written. I think it's an absolutely outstanding film.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's my favourite Danny Boyle film. There you go.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's so good. And I really, really loved watching it again.
Oh, good stuff.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything you've said. It's just a objectively brilliant film, I think. Just well made in every way. Yeah. Probably wouldn't say it's my favourite Boyle.
Okay.
I still think 28 Days Later
would probably be that
for me.
Ironically, 28 Days Later is an easier watch.
Yeah, it is. Like, I couldn't just believe how much this whipped along as well. It's only like 92 minutes long.
Yeah.
Perfect length. Thought the performances were brilliant. I love the way that they're sort of modulated so that you've got this incredibly loud, obnoxious character in Alex it's a very still, reserved character in David, and then Juliet's almost kind of like a combo of the two. She can be fun, but she can be reserved, and that's sort of what made Ewan McGregor's performance kind of bearable for me, was just having that kind of contrast with... He does a really good performance for the character, but I really did find the character so fucking obnoxious.
Oh, absolutely.
And you're supposed to. And that surprised me, because I do remember coming away from the first watch being like, he was the kind of like the likeable one.
Isn't he great?
Yeah. But, you know, maybe that was a reflection of what I was like in, when I was 18. But, you know, I just thought it was such a good film.
Yeah.
For a first film and a film with no budget, could have been very easy for Danny Boyle to slip into kind of film school kind of techniques, and he just shies away from that. He's obviously so assured in his own sort of style and vision that he avoids.
Well, he's from a theatre background.
Yeah,
he was a theatre director with the RSC.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the Royal Shakespeare Company, not the Rocksteady Crew, obviously. Again, that's when people accuse him of that style over content.
Yeah.
He comes from theatre, he comes from TV.
Deliberately theatrical.
Yeah, he worked with Alan Clark and people like that in TV. Yeah. You know, he produced Elephant.
Yeah.
So he knows what he's doing.
He's someone who can use the artifice of a film to his own end deliberately. Yeah, apparently this is Danny Boyle's father's favourite film.
Is that right?
So, like, apparently after every new film that comes out, even like Slumdog, where he won the Oscar...
Yeah.
His dad says, oh, it was good, but it wasn't as good as Shallow Grave.
Well, I'm with Mr. Boyle.
You're with Mr. Boyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Lance Boyle, I think his name is.
It's one of my favourite jokes. I love that.
I really enjoyed watching this again.
Great.
It was so good.
I'm really pleased.
Yeah. Other than a lack of smartphones, there's not really anything that... dates it too much.
No, not at all.
And the fact that the accountant firm that he works for is from 1942. But other than that, it just holds up in every way. Did make me think Kerry Fox should be kind of like winning Oscars. And
I suppose that's the only sadness to it. But like you said, she may be following the career that she wants.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm very, very pleased. I'm so glad you enjoyed it again.
Oh, it was great.
Right.
What's next?
Well, next will be our Halloween special. I think we're going to try and record it relatively early so it comes out in time for Halloween.
Oh, that would be a first.
It will be. And we're having a guest for Halloween.
Hey!
I don't think we've had a Halloween guest since Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh.
Which is four years ago with Fran.
Yeah.
So we are bringing back an old familiar face.
Okay.
Andy Burt's coming back.
Hey, Andy.
And he has chosen The Frighteners.
Hey! Excellent.
Yeah. Strange, it's the second Michael J. Fox film. That Andy's chosen as well.
Excellent. Wow, it is.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That was deliberate.
Maybe. Maybe he's got a thing for him.
Thing for Fox.
Yeah. Let's do a bit of housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook. And if you want to email us, it's stillanygood@gmail.com. And if you wouldn't mind, just go and rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
That'd be lovely.
Super. Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Get out into that rain now. Oh, it is absolutely chucking it down.
It
so,
is pissing down.
Good luck.
All right.
Okay, folks, we'll see you soon.
See you.
Cheerio. Something to talk about.
Shorten the Street from 12 years ago.
Okay, it is time to do a little bit of housework. Not housework, let's say that again.
What? Fuck, I did not come here to. I mean, I know the garage could do with a bit of a tidy up.
Yeah, it's time to do the dishes.